You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicar.
Coming up on this week's Parish Council, a special edition, these are a few of my favourite things.
Well, hello everybody and welcome back to the Parish Council. This is the podcast from the Rocking Vicar. I'm Magnus Shaw and in a brown paper package tied up with string, he's Terence Dackham.
Hello, Magnus Shaw.
Howdy.
That's I like that. Yeah. That's very good. Because here, in fact, here's the thing, actually. No, here's the thing. Because we're recording this special. These are a few of my favourite things.
Ah, you see what we did there. We don't just throw this rubbish together.
That was good. That's good. It's a special podcast recording a few days ahead of its release date. So if anybody mentioned dies... or gets arrested in the meantime. Everyone will have to understand why we haven't mentioned it here.
No.
Yeah, a bit of a special because I'm away living what I believe they call in continental circles the Dolce Vita.
La Vida Loca.
Yes. And so we've picked a handful of categories and we're going to select our favourite of all time in those categories. And, I was thinking, if I told you in a month's time that my favourite thing in all the world is something else entirely to what I'm picking here, do bear in mind that for me, my absolute favourite thing ever that will never ever change changes about 2 minutes later. So when I say these are my favourite things, it's my favourite things today, Magnus Shaw.
Yeah, well, this is the great peril with an exercise like this, isn't it? That you can labour all day and all night coming up with the absolute definitive list. And having sweated blood and tears, you realise that if you'd have done it on a different day, you'd have got a different outcome. So all you can proffer is your favourite things on that particular day, I think.
At this point in time. So, first category on these are a few of my favourite things. Favourite album of all time, Magnus Shaw. No doubt you're going for the Manic Street Preachers.
Well, yes, I can't say it's not tempting to go for the Manic Street Preachers. And they were on the list. They were slated. They'd certainly.
They were on your long list.
They were on the short list too. Oh. I gave some heavy consideration to picking Everything Must Go. Now, I know Manic's purists may balk at that and go for the Holy Bible, but I just think Everything Must Go is a tremendous record. Relaunched them out of that really traumatic period that they went through, and they did it with such style and such grace and such power. They could have fallen apart and lesser bands would have done, and they didn't. They produced Everything Must Go, which is just fantastic. However, having almost given that the nod, I thought, well, what about soul music? I mean, I love soul music, big fan of soul music, and that immediately sent me rushing for What's Going On. You see, What's Going On, such an amazing album. Again, made by a fella at a crossroads in his life and his career, and it just brought out the very best in Marvin Gaye, didn't it? And dragged soul music kicking and screaming out of the pop genre into something much deeper and more profound, and with such class and style. I mean, it's amazing. Can be played over and over again, and something new to be found. And like my pen was hovering over What's Going On, and I thought, well, but what about folk music? What's about those? Some great American songwriters like Paul Simon. And I thought, well, Bridge Over Troubled Water, surely Bridge Over Troubled Water is the finest album I've ever heard. It's just a superlative piece of songwriting that's touched by the hand of God. But then you've got El Condor Passes on there, which you've pointed this out to me before, haven't you? It's the fly in the ointment. It's the concrete round the foot of Bridge Over Troubled Water. It's not terrible, but it's a few notches below the Boxer and such like. Maybe then I moved on from there, and I thought, well, there's punk rock, as punk rock transformed my way of thinking, and made my teenagehood something much far more special than it would have been otherwise. And so I thought, well, the Clash were my favourite band, and London Calling is an exceptional album, groundbreaking album. Took, the first punk band to go somewhere else and try something different and do it with such brilliance, And that almost made it too. But actually, finally, I put all those to one side and picked Scary Monsters and Super Creeps by David Bowie. Because I think, setting aside the fact that there's a reprise of one track, and I never sure what a reprise is for, and I do wonder to this day whether that's not there to make up the running time for Scary Monsters, but setting that aside, it is perfect. In every aspect, Scary Monsters and Super Creeps, recorded off the back of the Berlin Trilogy, and a lesser artist would be, I think, in the creative wilderness, wouldn't they, after the Berlin Trilogy? You know, you've done Heroes, you've done Lodger, you've done Low. Then what? And I think a lot of artists will be left scratching their head. Bowie just raised his game a notch further and produced this album that sounds like nothing else did at the time, and nothing else quite since has sounded like it. Endlessly inventive, superb band around him, you know, Carlos Alomar on guitar, and I don't know if Earl Slick was in the band by then, but anyway, no. You catch my drift. The musicians around him just as creative as Bowie, and these very odd but immediately accessible tracks that just one after the other, and of course all tops with the cherry that is Ashes to Ashes, which I still think is probably the greatest number one single we ever saw in this country. I know you throw the Beatles at me, but we'll fight in the car park later. But there you go. I think, you know, for at least for today, Scary Monsters and Super Creeps is just impeccable.
Well, here's this. 1980, a year that was to be the unhappiest of my life. It would usher in a decade that would prove to be frustrating, disheartening. And while it had some real highs, it was ultimately downright awful for my career. That's not me, by the way. That's Tony Visconti in his autobiography about his state of mind when starting work on Scary Monsters. And I'm going to just tell you a couple of things from his autobiography, because I absolutely recommend it. If you're interested, as clearly Magnus Shaw is, in Scary Monsters and Super Creeps, Tony Visconti's autobiography, which is called Bowie, Boland and the Brooklyn Boy, it just gives you so much background information there's obviously all of Visconti's work, but particularly the key moments in David Bowie's career. Just as an aside, at the first session, to put it in its time, at the first session for Scary Monsters, David Bowie showed Tony Visconti, Carlos Alomar, Dennis Davis, and George Murray, who were the band at the time, he showed them the first ever Sony Walkman. He walked in and said, look at this. And they spent ages mucking about with David Bowie's Sony Walkman. But and it also gives you an idea of the atmosphere. A few minutes after that, according to Visconti's book, he was sobbing in David Bowie's arms because Visconti's marriage to Mary Hopkin was over, and he was absolutely distraught. Yeah. And David Bowie said, well, you know, do you want to go home? Do you want to stay? And, you know, that's all in the book. But It's fascinating in showing the process by which David Bowie creates songs. They had a song with a funky beat, and Bowie would sing, ooh, ooh, Jamaica. and it was only at the very, very last minute, according to Tony Visconti, it became, of course, you know, ooh, ooh, fashion. But there was just one little piece, Magnus Shaw, that I wanted to read out to you, if that's okay.
Sure.
Because David Bowie, Visconti didn't know this was happening, and Pete Townsend is coming to the studio today, announced David apprehensively. And I'll just read you a bit about what happened when Townsend came, because Visconti says, you know, he'd been reading about how Pete Townsend had been drinking, and he was still breaking up hotel rooms, and of course, as I've just explained, Tony Visconti was in a bit of a strange place too. So this is what he says. When Townsend arrived, he seemed to be in a foul, laconic mood. David asked if there was anything we could get for him, and he asked for a bottle of wine. I asked if he wanted red or white, and he snarled back, there's no such thing as white wine. So I was only hoping he wouldn't hurl the empty bottle through my studio window. He sort of settled in and asked what we want him to do on this track. David looked at me kind of puzzled and asked, chords? And Townsend asked, well, what kind of chords? And I think both David and I were a little afraid to state the obvious, but I finally offered, well, Pete Townsend chords. So Townsend shrugged and said, oh, windmills, and did a perfect windmill on his guitar, traditionally grazing his right-hand knuckles. Within 30 minutes, the chords were laid on the track, the bottle of red wine was drained, and Townsend exited into Dean Street. So
there you go.
There's a little insight into the recording of Scary Monsters.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think that sort of chaos and, you know, emotional fracture, it's in there in the record. It's it's quite a spiky, angular record, but in a completely wonderful way.
Yes, and well, on such strange seesaws are great albums born.
Yes, this is quite true, yes. Yeah, I mean, you could relate similar tales about what's going on, I think, really, the state of mind that Marvin Gaye was in when he recorded that. So, yeah, I guess their agony is our benefit.
But from that aforementioned album, Scary Monsters, here is Ooh, Ooh, Fashion.
The people from back home again and again.
are David Bowie's Scary Monsters, recorded at the Power Station in New York, and as we learned with the Townsend anecdote, some overlays back in London. When they're in the Power Station in New York, Magnus Shaw, Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band were recording next door. And that was how Roy Bittan came to play piano on three tracks on Your Scary Monsters.
So which E Street Band album would that have been?
Do you know, that's a good question, isn't it? Yeah, I did research that, yeah.
Yes, it'd be interesting to know. Because I can't think of an E Street Band album that has any kind of parallel with Scary Monsters and Super Kids. They weren't rubbing off on each other in a sort of Pink Floyd Beatles way at all, were they? It'd be interesting to know which one it was.
Somebody's just said to me in my ear that they're guessing it was The River, because that was recorded in 1980.
Yeah, that sounds right, doesn't it? Yeah.
And now I've been told that that's confirmed. It's The River. It was being recorded at the Power Station in New York at the same time.
Interesting. Yeah, you imagine walking into the canteen at the Power Station and trying to decide whether to sit down with Bowie and his band or Springsteen. and then just running out in sheer confusion and terror, yes.
Yes, well, actually, funny enough, I keep referring to this autobiography, there's another funny story in it, which I'm now paraphrasing because I've put the book down again. But they were having dinner in the studios of the Power Station. When they were recording both, as we now know, The River and Scary Monsters. Yeah. And Dennis Davis, the drummer, sat down with Bruce Springsteen and said, oh, you know, I like the look of your dinner. And apparently Springsteen gave him his dinner because, you know, he being that kind of a fellow, and said, well, you have it. Yeah. You know, I'm not that hungry. You have it. And then Dennis Davis turned to him, saying, bearing in mind this is 1980, and as we said, they just recorded The River, and said, and are you in a band?
Brilliant.
a very strange session, I should imagine, at the Power Station. Indeed. But again, just endorses why it's well worth investing. You probably get it for a penny on Amazon these days. Tony Visconti's autobiography, Bowie Bolan and the Brooklyn Boy. Mm, excellent. Yeah. I had three contenders, Magnus Shaw, for best album of all time. I had PM Dawn's The Bliss album, Vibrations of Love and Anger and the Ponderance of Life and Existence. 15 tracks on this album, 7 of them released as single A-sides, which is extraordinary. It's just obviously in my top 3 albums of all time. And also, as you mentioned, The Clash, London Calling, not so much for the quality of the 19 tracks, again, as you referred to, but for the return to form after a difficult period. And, I often think, and I think even people close to the band would say, would probably agree, there's at least 8 killer tracks that would have made an outstanding single album, in retrospect. But I've gone for the completely obvious, the Beatles and Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. I wrote quite recently about how I came to hear Sgt. Pepper through what was then an exclusive advance play on the pirate radio ship's radio station, Radio London. And Sgt. Pepper, the album, it was a programme presented by John Peel and Ed Stewpot Stewart. It was an unlikely combination, as I think we have mentioned. And in order to try and stop other stations recording the album and then, you know, stealing their glory, Radio London played placed jingles and idents all through the track. So to this day, in my mind, I still hear, "She's leaving home, wonderful Radio London, goodbye."
It doesn't go a long way to enhance the LP, does it?
It doesn't. No, you see, we taped it on an old reel-to-reel tape recorder and just kept playing it, and so of course that's now, you know, absolutely deep in my brain. Recorded as we would have expected in Studio 2, Abbey Road, Sgt. Pepper is a flawed album. In retrospect, what a mistake to drop Strawberry Fields Forever and Penny Lane and release them as a double-sided single to appease EMI. Indeed, George Martin says dropping those two songs was, quote, "the biggest mistake of my professional life," from his book, The Making of Sgt. Pepper. And this did lead to one or two All That'll Do tracks appearing in the album, but that can't detract from the extraordinary impact the album had when it was released on 1st of June 1967. It went straight to number one, and it stayed there. It was a bizarre summer, 1967, the so-called Summer of Love, but there were what were then called race riots all across America. The Vietnam War seemed to have no end in sight, and it, I suppose, closer to what we're talking about here in Beatle News, by August 67, Brian Epstein was dead. So in context, Sgt. Pepper is a bit of a confused album, but still, it just stands alone, peerless, as an icon of its age, a piece of art laid down on a four-track recording desk in St. John's Wood.
I'm fixing a hole where the rain gets in and stops my mind from wandering where it will go. I'm filling the cracks that ran through the door and kept my mind from wandering where it will go.
Fixing a Hole from Sgt. Pepper, recorded 9th and 21st of February 1967, written by Paul about fixing up his newly acquired farmhouse in Scotland. A huge contribution by George Martin on harpsichord, and the only track on Sgt. Pepper where McCartney actually plays the bass live. He dubbed the bass on for all the other tracks, so I wasn't quite a teenager, but my heart was lost to Sergeant Pepper. Now, our next category These Are a Few of My Favourite Things, selecting a favourite book, and it's a very difficult one for me, as I tend to read books once and then put them on a shelf and rarely read them again. I pondered about picking P.G. Woodhouse, but I couldn't choose one from his masterpieces. And I nearly picked a book that had a massive impact on me as a young man, Of Human Bondage by Somerset Maugham. And I also enjoyed Enid Blyton's The Mystery of series. And I've got the whole set of them on my Kindle for my trip away. I want to reread those and recapture the 8-year-old, 9-year-old me. Mm. However, I went back to my favourite writer of all time, a woman who uses words with absolutely breathtaking style and tells stories through creative language to the extent that every sentence reads as though it should be printed out and framed. I love her quote that when she's working on a book, she has to sleep in the same room where she's writing. The quote is, "The book doesn't leave you when you're right next to it." And I think that's really lovely. Joan Didion is the greatest writer I know, and her work, The Year of Magical Thinking, is the most powerful book I've ever read. I think if I tell you that it's her memory of 2003 to 2004, the year after her husband died, you may think, uh-oh, you know, this could be just a misery memoir, but it's nothing of the sort. It does deal with her grief, but it's much more about you and me and how we lurch through life and how what happens to us affects us as people and how so often we keep replaying the same events and behaviour. I can't recommend it enough. My favourite book of all time, Joan Didion, The Year of Magical Thinking.
Life changes fast. Life changes in the instant. You sit down to dinner and life as you know it ends. The question of self-pity. Chapter 1. Those were the first words I wrote after it happened. The computer dating on the Microsoft Word file, notes on change.doc, reads May 20th, 2004, 11:11 p.m. But that would have been a case of my opening the file and reflexively pressing save when I closed it. I had made no changes to that file in May. I had made no changes to that file since I wrote the words in January 2004. A day or two or three after the fact. For a long time, I wrote nothing else. Life changes in the instant, the ordinary instant. At some point, in the interest of remembering what seemed most striking about what had happened, I considered adding those words, the ordinary instant. I saw immediately that there would be no need to add the word ordinary, because there would be no forgetting it. The word never left my mind. It was, in fact, the ordinary nature of everything preceding the event that prevented me from truly believing it had happened, absorbing it, incorporating it, getting past it. I recognize now that there was nothing unusual in this. Confronted with sudden disaster, we all focus on how unremarkable the circumstances were in which the unthinkable occurred, the clear blue sky from which the plane fell, the routine errand that ended on the shoulder with the car in flames, the swings where the children were playing, as usual, when the rattlesnake struck from the ivy. He was on his way home from work, happy, successful, healthy, and then gone. I read in the account of a psychiatric nurse whose husband was killed in a highway accident. In 1966, I happened to interview many people who had been living in Honolulu on the morning of December 7th, 1941. Without exception, these people began their accounts of Pearl Harbor by telling me what an ordinary Sunday morning it had been. It was just an ordinary, beautiful September day. People still say, when asked to describe the morning in New York, when American Airlines 11 and United Airlines 175 got flown into the World Trade Towers. Even the report of the 9/11 Commission opened on this insistently premonitory and yet still dumbstruck narrative note. Tuesday, September 11th, 2001, dawned temperate and nearly cloudless in the eastern United States. And then, gone. In the midst of life, we are in death, Episcopalians say at the graveside. Later, I realized that I must have repeated the details of what happened to everyone who came to the house in those first weeks. All those friends and relatives who brought food and made drinks and laid out plates on the dining room table for however many people were around at lunch or dinner time. All those who picked up the plates and froze the leftovers and ran the dishwasher and filled our, I could not yet think my, otherwise empty house, even after I had gone into the bedroom, our bedroom, the one in which there still lay on a sofa a faded terry cloth extra-large robe bought in the 1970s at Richard Carroll in Beverly Hills, and shut the door. Those moments when I was abruptly overtaken by exhaustion are what I remember most clearly about the first days and weeks. I have no memory of telling anyone the details, but I must have done so because everyone seemed to know them. At one point, I considered the possibility that they had picked up the details of the story from one another, but immediately rejected it. The story they had was in each instance too accurate to have been passed from hand to hand. It had come from me.
If there's one thing that fired me up as a young man, as much as punk rock did shortly before punk rock, my whole life was consumed with horror stories and horror films. And I read Bram Stoker's Dracula so many times, and have read it so many times as an adult as well. You talked about very rarely rereading. I'm quite an avid rereader, I must say. And Bram Stoker's Dracula I've reread many times. I reread it earlier this year. And that is just a very significant book for me. And I love the fact that it's written in the style of journals and diaries. If people were actually realize the original Dracula story was written as diaries and journals, but so it was. And I occasionally visit Whitby as well, and I see the house where Bram Stoker wrote Dracula, and some of the scenes, the beaches and things that appear in the novel are there in Whitby as well. So that was a good one, but I moved on from that, as you have to. Michael Moorcock's Behold the Man, which is an extended short story, really, is a really fascinating rewriting of the story of Jesus from Jesus's point of view, with a sort of science fantasy bent to it. And I've always enjoyed it. I haven't reread it for a long time, but I enjoyed that a great deal. And it's not a book that many people know, even if they know Moorcock, so that's worth tracking down. That didn't cross the line either. The New Confessions by William Boyd, I devour everything William Boyd writes, and I don't really read novels as a rule. In later life, in middle age, I'm almost totally a non-fiction reader, but I will read anything William Boyd writes, and this is my favourite book from William Boyd. It's a faux autobiography. It's the story of a man who never existed, but it's written as if he did, and it just takes somebody in a moment in time, or a life in a moment in time, which coincides with the invention of cinema, and how one man's life is changed by this new art form. It's so much more than that, but I won't go into details, and that very nearly came to the top. But I've never been so affected by a book as I have been by J.D. Salinger's The Catcher in the Rye. Now, I'm happy to stand corrected, but I just wonder whether women who were once girls ever have the same experience reading The Catcher in the Rye as young men do, because it is about a young man, and it is about the thoughts, the feelings, the impressions, the misjudgments, the bad decisions, and indeed the mental breakdown of a young teenage man. And I know it's not unique to me, because I've spoken to many people, young old men who used to be young men, about this, and it just somehow, with some kind of psychic surgery, just captures in little bubbles everything that it is to be a young teenage man. It's the moments when Holden Caulfield is walking through New York, and instead of concentrating on finding somewhere to sleep, or maybe even going home and going back to school, he's pretending to be a gangster and that he's being followed by mobsters. And I think this is what young teenage men do. They walk around pretending to be other things. And Salinger captures it in such an incredible way. It's a compelling story. It's a very touching and moving story. But its ability to get inside the psyche of a teenage young man is just extraordinary. I read it when I was the age of Holden Caulfield, and I think that's why it just slapped the handcuffs on me and will never be bettered.
If you really want to hear about it, the first thing you'll probably want to know is where I was born and what my lousy childhood was like and how my parents were occupied and all before they had me and all that David Copperfield kind of crap, but I don't feel like going into it if you want to know the truth. In the first place, that stuff bores me. And in the second place, my parents would have about 2 hemorrhages apiece if I told anything pretty personal about them. They're quite touchy about anything like that, especially my father. They're nice and all, I'm not saying that, but they're also touchy as hell. Besides, I'm not going to tell you my whole goddamn autobiography or anything. I'll just tell you about this madman stuff that happened to me around last Christmas, just before I got pretty run down and had to come out here and take it easy. I mean, that's all I told DB about. He's my brother and all. He's in Hollywood. That isn't too far from this crumbly place, and he comes over and visits me practically every weekend. He's going to drive me home when I go home next month, maybe. He just got a Jaguar. One of those little English jobs that can do around 200 miles an hour. It cost him damn near $4,000. He's got a lot of dough now. He didn't used to. He used to be just a regular writer when he was home. He wrote this terrific book of short stories, The Secret Goldfish, in case you've never heard of him. The best one in it was The Secret Goldfish. It was about this little kid that wouldn't let anybody look at his goldfish because he bought it with his own money. It killed me. Now he's out in Hollywood, DB, being a prostitute. If there's one thing I hate, it's the movies. Don't even mention them to me. What I want to start telling is the day I left Pensy Prep. Pensy Prep is the school that's in Angerstown, Pennsylvania. You've probably heard of it. You've probably seen the ads, anyway. They advertise it about 1,000 magazines, always showing some hotshot guy on a horse jumping over a fence. Like as if all you ever did at Pensy was play polo all the time. I never even once saw a horse anywhere near the place. And underneath the guy on the horse's picture, it always says, "Since 1888, we have been molding boys into splendid, clear-thinking young men." Strictly for the birds. They don't do any damn more molding at Pensy than they do at any other school. I didn't know anybody there that was splendid and clear-thinking and all. Maybe 2 guys. If that many. And they probably came to Pensy that way.
In the Rye, I probably read it at exactly the wrong time for me as a rather confused teenager, and so I found it somewhat scary.
Yeah,
it was a sort of time when I needed to be told, stay cool and everything will turn out okay. And then I reread it in December 1980, and it had an equally disturbing impact on me then. But,
I quite liked the notion that it is okay to walk around pretending to somebody else. I found that enormously reassuring, actually.
When I knew that you'd chosen it as your favourite book of all time, I skim read some pages today, and I have to say, I immediately felt a wee bit intimidated again, but I'm not saying that's particularly a bad thing. Yeah. You know, it's a very powerful book, and it had exactly the impact on me, really, that you've been describing. Of the time that you read it, particularly if you're a teenager. The third category in our "These Are a Few of My Favourite Things" is favourite TV show. And I know you found it hard to trim down your list on this one as well.
This was the worst. This was almost worse than music. Immediately you're faced with untold genre, you know, from drama to comedy to current affairs to documentary to where do you begin to select a favorite TV show? Terribly, terribly difficult. Having very firmly scrolled down the screen and typed in The Simpsons without a shadow of a doubt, just about to move on to the next category, I thought, yes, ooh, no, but hold on. And I think, you know, in many ways, The Simpsons is the best TV show ever made. I just think for its sheer creative audacity, it just stands out from everything else. But I didn't, actually. It was probably watching the Stuart Lee thing that pulled me to this. I selected The Day Today as just the finest satire that has ever been on British television. And not only is it satirical, it's predictive. It's a soothsayer of a comedy show in that watching the news in 2014 is very similar to watching The Day Today. Chris Morris saw exactly where Current Affairs was going and spoofed it actually before it got there, which I think shows an enormously intelligent brain at work. And, of course, it gave us Alan Partridge, incidentally spun off another genius comedy character as it went along. And it's just the perfection of observation, I think. It's just everything is just so perfectly observed. And that would be good enough, perhaps. But into the bargain, it is uproariously funny. And I could watch each episode without the humour diminishing at all. Every time I watch any episode of The Day Today, it is still as good as it ever was. Much as I'm in awe of Stuart Lee, I'm completely besotted with Chris Morris and his work. I think he's probably a man out of time. I think we will look back on Chris Morris in decades to come and realise that he really was in a class of his own as a comedy writer. So my pick is The Day Today is my favourite TV show.
Welcome. On The Day Today tonight, David Owen emerges shattered from Oliver Reed.
I don't think I've ever seen anything quite such so totally wanton, ghastly mess, terrible.
And Portillo's wife defends crack habit.
It's cheap, very cheap.
Hello, you. Prince Charles has volunteered to put himself in prison in order to highlight the plight of Britain's jails.
The Prince made the announcement at some speech or other he was giving today. He said he wanted to set an example. The Prince has been preparing for his ordeal for the last 2 months by attending practice prison in a Rolls-Royce factory, sharing his cell with an old school friend. When he starts for real at Brixton next Tuesday, he'll be expected to muck in just like any other convict detained at his mother's pleasure, adopting the regulation haircut and activity programs. The Prince's choice, making a brush.
I am determined, as far as I'm concerned, to try at least. And in that sense, it will be my own small contribution towards a vision of Britain.
Tomorrow sees the opening of the London Jam Festival, selling pots of jam, some made by celebrities, to raise money for the homeless. With me is one of the organisers, Janet Breen. Janet, thanks for joining us this evening. This must have taken a heck of a lot of organising.
Yes, well, it has, actually. To get all the celebrities to contribute their jam has really been quite an operation.
How much of your time did you put into it?
Oh, I would say at least 6 months.
6 months? To raise money for a jam festival? Isn't that rather stupid?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it's all in a good cause.
Well,
it's for
good
the
cause,
homeless.
Yeah, but how much are you going to raise?
Well, we hope to raise at least £1,500.
£1,500? That's a pathetic amount of money. You can raise more money by auctioning dogs.
Well, I don't think so. I think it's all in a good cause and very worthwhile and worth
doing. You persuaded these celebrities to waste their time donating to it?
Yes.
Well, who?
Glenys Kinnick we've got and Sebastian Coe.
I hate Sebastian Coe.
Well, I feel he's made a very worthwhile contribution.
What,
actually,
to the paltry sum of £1,500?
Yes.
Is that worth 6 months of your time?
Well, I think it is worth...
I don't think it is at all. I think the only reason you've done it is to make yourself look important. How dare you come on this programme and say, hey, look at me, I'm raising £1,500 for the homeless. You could raise more money by sitting outside a tube station with a hat on the ground, even if you were twice as ugly as you are, which is very ugly indeed.
Well, only in the UK, really, I think, could a man leave the University of Bristol with a degree in zoology and then go on to create On the Hour and the Day, yeah. The Day Today. I mean, it was, of course, on GLR, Greater London Radio, from its launch, where he drove several producers to hair-pulling angst. Matthew Bannister always says that Chris Morris was, and I'm quoting here, always his biggest single headache. Chris Morris described in the Daily Mail as unspeakably sick I was looking up the cuttings.
Well, that's the best review you can have in the history of your entire career, isn't it? If the Daily Mail turns its nose up at you, you're onto something, I think.
And, I thought worth mentioning is that, you know, like Fawlty Towers are only 12 episodes made, and everybody thinks, were there? Of course, there were only six episodes of the day-to-day ever made. We tend to think it was a long-running show, or at least many would.
Absolutely, it's you know, we have to trust a judgment there that Morris felt that, and Armando Iannucci, you know, his partner in crime, felt that you know, they'd covered all the bases with that. I would not like to be sitting here saying, but the second series wasn't very good. That would be awful.
Well, my choice for a Tip Top TV show was easy for me. A passing nod to the Wooden Tops, and you know, they came close, and a very big, heavy nod to Seinfeld, which one could say, of course, was the parent of the show that I'm picking. I could only choose Larry David's paean to the human condition, Curb Your Enthusiasm. Now running to 80 episodes since October 2000.
Good. I had no idea.
80 episodes, eight seasons. So about half as many as its parents, Seinfeld. But worryingly, no new Curb Your Enthusiasm since 2011. Rumours keep coming out, you know, yes, he will, no, he won't. But only Larry David will be able to answer that, and I'm not entirely sure he knows himself. Curb Your Enthusiasm, it portrays the sometimes, well, quite often, excruciating life of Larry David as he glides through his time on this earth in Los Angeles, and deals with Larry David's seeming inability to interact with people, leading to a series of faux pas and social situations where he never learns the value of the phrase, "When you're in a hole, stop digging." He hates small talk, but then often finds himself engaged with people in the line at the coffee shop, usually with disastrous consequences. If Larry is horrendously rude to a woman in a parking lot, you just know she'll turn out to be the executive interviewing him as he pitches his show to NBC 5 minutes later. Simply the greatest, most skillful, creative use of the media of television, Larry David, Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Hey, pick up some food to go, David.
Okay, one second.
Okay.
Larry? Larry, hi.
Doug, we're both in New York.
Yeah, we're both
Look
in
at this,
New
York. Two Angelinos here in New York.
That's something, isn't it?
What are you here for?
Hey, you know, I just came.
Hey, here's a thought. Let's go to lunch tomorrow.
I don't think so.
Okay, Thursday.
No, I don't think so.
Why not?
Well, we don't really see each other in L.A. So why, if we're in one city all the time and we never have lunch in that city, why would we have lunch in the new city?
Well, you see what this is?
We don't have lunch
You're
together
still holding
in LA.
A grudge because we didn't invite you to Joni's bat mitzvah. You'll never forgive me for that.
No.
I'm telling you, we sent it out. You were on the list.
I did get the invitation.
Yeah.
Yes, and I paid so little attention to it that I didn't even bother to RSVP because I shouldn't have been invited in the first place. I was offended that I was invited.
So let me get this straight. I'm going to eat alone tomorrow.
Why do you want to eat with me?
Because we never get a chance to eat in L.A.
Because we're not friends.
We're not friends because we never spend time together.
We don't spend time together because I don't want to spend time together.
Is it possible that you have a little room for growth?
No. Duckstein, I think we've taken this about as far as we can. There'll be no lunch, no breakfast, or dinner. There won't be a snack. There won't be coffee. There won't be a drink, and hopefully there won't even be another bump into.
I feel badly for you, because life is like this.
Yes.
And what you've done is made it like this.
I want to make that smaller.
Really?
Yes. Shrink it. Put the hands together. That's what I want. See you, Duckstein.
Bye, Larry.
Yes, really, really good pick, actually, and you know, I wouldn't counter it in any way at all. I think it is just a fantastic reality show, and as soon as you start talking about it, all the episodes run back through your mind, don't they? I mean, just shamefully neglected on BBC Two, as was Seinfeld. I mean, I can only imagine that nobody at BBC Two, you know, could tell the value of what they had on their hands, and therefore took them safely away, in inverted commas, at like 11:45 at night. What on earth were they thinking? Because, you know, especially for me, Curb Your Enthusiasm. Seinfeld never grabbing quite the same way, but Curb Your Enthusiasm, I think, is just terrific. Somebody lent me the box set, and I devoured it, and then went and devoured it all again. Larry David... You know, to have that capacity to observe yourself and then mock yourself is quite something. And I love him. Yes, I love the whole lot. I think perhaps my favourite episode of Curb is when he hires the chef and believes him to be an Auschwitz survivor because he has a number on his inside arm. And then the whole episode revolves around the guy not being a very good chef, but Larry not being able to fire him because he's an Auschwitz survivor, and he has a lot of, you know, Jewish guilt about the whole situation and everything. And then the payoff at the end is it turns out that he had a phone number written in biro. And so one day Larry realizes the number's not there anymore. He could have fired him weeks ago. And that's just brilliant, just brilliant. And of course, you know, to see Larry writhe and squirm and wrestle with his Jewish heritage is where the humour comes from. Yeah, brilliant, brilliant.
The hardest category of all for me was this, our fourth one, which is, what's your favourite chocolate bar or candy? And how I love those four for a penny Black Jackson fruit salads, and also those little pink polystyrene-looking shrimps.
Yeah,
I think you still get those. Sherbet dip dabs as well. I still love Maynard's wine gums.
Double dip.
Oh, never double dip. Yes.
There was a sweet ball double dip, wasn't there?
Oh, I thought you were referring back to Curb Your Enthusiasm there, because Larry gets into a great deal of trouble in an episode
but don't you remember there was a sachet of orange sherbet and a sachet of, I think, grape sherbet, maybe, and then in a thin, smaller sachet, this is all attached in one sheet, was a... like a sugar stick to dip into either or.
Oh, that sounds like a northern thing to me. Yeah. I'm an expert on sweets, candy, and chocolate. Like, and I don't remember that one.
The Mattisons have a big warehouse just down the road from me here to this day.
That's probably it. They were testing them on you. They were testing their products on the young Magna Shore. I mean, Fry's five-by chocolate had scary faces on each square, and I pondered about that, and Fry's chocolate cream, a different flavour in every segment.
Oh, no, you see, Fry's chocolate cream was the one that was white all the way through, and Fry's five centres was...
Five centres, that's the one, isn't it, with the different flavours, that's right. And chocolate cream was the white kind of gooey thing. That's true. Kit Kat Flake, and the chocolate bar that came a close second, Coffee Crisp, which disappeared in the 1960s, but was just the yummiest bar of gorgeousness ever invented.
Oh, coffee chocolate doesn't do it for me.
I know not many people remember this, but it was really, really, you know, absolutely the epitome of gorgeousness. Mm. But in the end, I chose that triangular mountain of joy, the Toblerone. Never lets you down with its pentahedron goodness of chocolate, nougat, almonds and honey. Thrilling us.
Is it actually a pentahedron?
It's a pentahedron. It's described as so on Toblerone's own website.
Right.
I actually went to the extreme of actually going to the Nestle website, and Toblerone described it as a pentahedron.
But so where does this leave the jingle, triangular honey from triangular bees?
I think perhaps there was a little bit of artistic license with the triangular bees.
There must have been,
Yes, it's Mr. Tobler. It was thrilling us with its combination. Mr. Tobler invented it, and Tyrone is an Italian nougat, so they put Tobler and Tyrone together to get Toblerone.
Okay,
And it's triangular shape, determined rather gloriously by a trip Mr. Tobler made to the Folies Bergères, where the dancers formed a pyramid at the end of the show. What? Scrumptious, enticing, ambrosia, the choice of champions, Toblerone.
Toblerone chocolate. First, drop in some cocoa beans. Add a little bit of honey. And finally, add some almonds to the mix. Blend all that together. With a bit of love for humanity, and you get Toblerone. Fair trade, fair chocolate.
Yeah, Toblerone, actually, I'm being slightly melodramatic, but not to any great extent, saved my life. When I was 19, I hitchhiked from Tel Aviv to London.
Yes.
Yeah. And halfway through Europe, I ran out of money. I think round about Austria, I ran out of money. Not a penny, not a cent to my name. And I found myself at a service station, starving, hungry, miserable. It was raining in the Austrian Alps, freezing cold. I didn't have any choice but to go and stand in the rain in order to hitchhike. And I was after standing there for about 2 hours, not getting a lift, I walked soggy into this service station, miserable as you like. And this service station, strangely, was deserted. Not a single member of staff to be seen, but the doors were open. And walking around, I stubbed my toe, swore loudly, looked down, and there, outside the sweet shop in this service station, was a delivered box of Toblerones, a wholesale box of Toblerones.
Wow.
And, well, you know, I'm honest as the day is long, as you well know, but I was starving, Terence. What could I do? So I stuffed my rucksack with Toblerones and went back out, got a lift, and fed myself all the way back to London on Toblerones.
Toblerones, yeah. My word. And, of course, the denouement of the story is that years later, feeling guilty, you went back to that store yes. and wrote them a cheque for, you know, 20 euros.
Of course I did. That's exactly what I did. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So that's why Toblerones have a special place in my memory, but I haven't picked Toblerone. Maybe I should have given them that tribute, but I haven't. I like you, I remembered bars past and gone. I thought about Nutties. Do you remember Nutties?
Oh, I do remember Nutties. Yeah, they were good.
Well, you see, the great thing about Nutties were that they were the chocolate bar that didn't have any chocolate.
That's right.
Chocolate bar. And it was stocked alongside the chocolate bars, but actually when you opened it, it was fudge encased in peanuts, wasn't it?
It was. It wasn't great for the teeth, no, I seem to remember. But
No, but, I like the novelty of the fact that somebody did a bar with no chocolate involved, and I used to eat a lot of those. My dad, every evening after dinner, would sit with a cup of coffee, his pipe, and a walnut whip, which for some reason he called a whipped cream walnut. He'd say to my mum, oh, Bet, I've left my whipped cream walnut in the kitchen. Would you bring it through?
Oh, what a lovely memory.
The place in my heart, the whipped cream walnuts, the walnut whip, and still available, of course, in all good confectioners. So I do like a walnut whip, but just nosing ahead of the whipped cream walnut into first place. And I get some kind of either giant bar or a pack of three at Christmas every year from my beloved family of mint Aeros. It's just, and then you pop them in the fridge, so they're as brittle as anything. And that combination of chili mint and the sweet chocolate, yeah, that's got to be the one for me, the mint Aero. And roll on Christmas, just talking about it, you know.
Yeah, splendidly sort of melty in the mouthy mint Aero.
It's all in the for me, chocolate's all in the texture. In the texture. I mean, it tastes nice, but it's all in the texture. Somebody says to me, do you fancy a piece of chocolate? And they open the packet and it's, you know, it's a hot summer's day or it's been in the pocket and it's soft and gooey.
No.
See, it's immediately not attractive, isn't it? It's got to be solid as a rock, preferably
absolutely
out of the fridge.
Agree with
yeah
you. Has to be out of the fridge. I keep all chocolate in this yeah house in the fridge yeah, including chocolate biscuits. Anything chocolate stays in the fridge in this
because
house because
the
it has to be.
The texture of crumbling chocolate in your mouth is where all the pleasure stems from.
Well, anybody who did anything different would be a fool.
I can only agree, yes.
Yeah, 5.1 grams of gorgeous saturated fat per bar with your Mint Aero. But do you know what, Magnus Shaw? Mm-hmm. In doing the copious research that I do for these things, we think... What flavours of Aero do we have over here? There's like orange, isn't there? There's, you know, your normal, and there's your mint.
Yeah.
In Japan, right, this is absolutely genuine. Anybody else can check on me at the end of the podcast.
Yeah.
They are mad on the Aero in Japan. They love their Aero in Japan, right? And these are some of the 20-odd flavours... 20 plus flavours of Aero that you can get in Japan.
That's great.
Green tea.
Oh, yeah.
Hot milk.
Hot milk.
Yeah. Vanilla milkshake.
Yes.
Strawberry. Bitter orange.
No.
Latte. Caramel. White chocolate Aero. Hot chocolate flavour. Oh. And my two favourites I've saved to the end for you here. Wasabi Aero. And imagine this one, a genuine flavour of Aero available in Japan as we speak. Mm-hmm. Sweet potato.
Oh, do you see? Is it like, I think we get mistreated in this country.
We're a third world country compared
yes,
to Japan.
Yes, well, I think it must be due to our traditionally tame palates. But the same thing happens when you go to the States and you're in the States and you go into a supermarket. You think, oh, well, I'll have a bit of chocolate while I'm here. You look at the Snickers section. There are four different kind of nuts. You've got your peanuts yeah that we get, but then you've got your hazelnut Snickers, your almond Snickers, so on and so forth. That's what you need, isn't it? You need a variety, a range there.
I tell you what, candy in America, Hershey, yeah, it's an acquired taste, isn't it?
Oh, horrible.
I know. Yeah. Well, I kind of, the first few bites of Hershey, I think, oh my God, this tastes like vomit.
Yes.
But then, as I say, it's an acquired taste, and then I find, you know, the bar's gone, and I'm kind of...
it's very acquired taste, the American chocolate, the American-made chocolate. The Snickers and stuff are pretty much taste the same. Of course, you have the different flavours, but the chocolate's similar. But the American-made chocolate, it's like cooking chocolate. It's very odd. It's very odd. Yeah, yeah.
But we're going to stick with our Toblerone and our Mint Aero.
Yes, indeed. Yes, lovely. Lovely.
The delicious new Aero. Now with more bubbles than ever. Join us on Facebook to make the world a bubblier place.
And so, to our final category, Magnus Shaw. Favourite single of all time, favourite 45, I suppose you could say, for older people like me. And, oh, typically, Magnus Shaw, you're bending the rules slightly here.
Yeah, I am slightly. Well, I don't know. It was 7 inches. And they played at 45. I think it played at 45. But it is an EP, if you will allow. But anyway, before I came to the conclusion that this was my favourite single-stroke EP of all time, I looked at a few others. Hot Love by T-Rex was the first single I ever bought. And I'm really delighted to report that I don't cringe when I hear it now. I groove out when I hear it now. It's lasted me, 40 years perhaps, a pleasure, without ever being an embarrassment. So it was quite tempting to invite Mr. Bolan onto the podium there. But I thought, well, we've done first singles before, and we've had conversations
we did,
about
that.
And I've written a piece about buying it and stuff. So I thought, okay, we'll park that.
Funnily enough, when I went away on the Dolce Vita last year, we did exactly that, didn't we? We did a looking a vinyl special.
Yeah,
didn't
we did.
That's where your Woman of Gold, who wasn't very old, cropped
yeah,
up.
Exactly, that's right. And then I just thought of, you know, Sterling Pop Records, which will last for all eternity. And I thought, yeah, knowing me, knowing you, obviously it's got the Partridge taint on it now, but remove it from that. Just staggering piece of pop writing, and I would happily put that up there. I just think it's heartrending, it's bittersweet, and just an incredibly well-written pop record. So that almost made it. Al Maz, for similar reasons. Randy Crawford's my favourite female vocalist ever, bar none, and Al Maz was her, you know, her big hit, and that's a beautiful song as well. Then God Save the Queen. I just remember buying God Save the Queen and bringing it home and playing it and just being astonished that I had no idea that music could be angry until I heard that and owned that, and I was just absolutely blown away that the rock or pop music could sound that angry. It was just such a visceral moment and visceral single, and that so nearly came close, but then I thought I'd cheat. So I picked this EP, which is called The Cost of Living, and it is by probably, it wavers a bit, but not much, I must say, my favourite band of all time, The Clash. And this was really their bridging record, I think. We'd had the second album, which everybody seemed very disappointed with. On reflection, I'm not sure why. It sounds brilliant when I listen to it now. But anyway, they were in the doldrums a bit. People were a bit dismissive of The Clash at this point. And they just popped out this EP, in lieu of a new record. And in a way, it was just sort of a statement of intention, is that, okay, you think the second album wasn't all that. Well, wait till you hear this. And the aim is that just blistering and super tight version of I Fought the Law. The live versions are just as good. It's just the way to cover a song. You know, you just get the impression they heard that record and thought, we can do justice for that, and just belt faultlessly. And then on the flip side, The Clash sounding much more like the E Streets band than the Exploited, because you've got Groovy, which has got harmonica on it and acoustic guitar on it, and then Gates of the West, which is probably my favourite Clash track. It's incredibly accomplished, adult-sounding song, with smart, poetic lyrics, and you get the impression that this is a reflection of their first visit to America. Loads of American references in there, and just sounds like a proper professional grown-up rock band in all the right ways. So three tracks all on one 7-inch record, and just so much quality packed into such a tiny little thing. Has to be my favorite single of all time, The Cost of Living EP from The Clash.
I had none. I fought the law and the law.
We are. He fought the law, but the law won.
Should just add, my wife has a little plaque that stands on a metal post on the edge of the garden that reads, "I fought the lawn and the lawn won."
Oh, very good. Very good.
It's a great.
She's cool, Mrs. the Magna Shaw. She's very cool. Theremin, sleigh bells, wind chimes, harpsichord, flutes, organ. Hal Blaine on drums, 90 hours of tape, $75,000 in recording costs over 9 months, 16 tracks mixed down to mono. Derek Taylor, the press man, called it a pocket symphony. It's the Beach Boys and Good Vibrations. Incredibly, in 1967, Good Vibrations was nominated in 3 Grammy categories and didn't win any of them. And the Beach Boys were denied a Grammy for Best Vocal Group Performance by the Anita Carr Quartet and their A Man and a Woman single.
Oh, quite right. I mean, who wouldn't have voted that over Good Vibrations?
It's amazing, yeah. Isn't it? Good Vibrations, it's a standard 4-in-the-bar pop song that breaks every rule, throwing in 3s over 4s and a shuffle beat. It's been copied through every decade since. There's highs and lows, crescendos, and a 20-bar section of church organ. If you were writing a guide to composing the perfect pop song, you wouldn't start here. Yet it's the most glorious, heavenly, blissful sound ever pressed on vinyl. There's an unspoken law of entertainment that generally holds true for TV, movies, books, radio, and indeed records. It's the law of Heaven's Gate. Which states that the longer a project takes, the more people involved and the more money vacuumed up in that process, the greater the failure the project is likely to be. But somehow, at a time when he was having massive panic attacks, ingesting vast amount of drugs and food that left him both obese and mentally ill, Brian Wilson produced the finest recorded work of a generation. Good Vibrations, it's symphonic without pomposity. It's a love song which contains as many na-na-nas and do-do-do's as reflections on the way the sunlight plays upon her hair. If we read the lyrics but we'd never heard the song, we might very well consider Good Vibrations was a leading example of bubblegum disposable pop, but of course it isn't. Brian Wilson, his predilection for getting the vocal going within the opening bar of many of his songs, and Good Vibrations follows that rule. Carl Wilson's angelic I love the colourful clothes she wears is accompanied only by Paul Tanner's that theremin that we refer to, and Carole Kaye's beautiful bass runs. At the 12-second mark, they're joined by the player who arguably contributes the greatest slice of drumming you'll ever hear on a pop record. If Hal Blaine had never played the drums again after this recording, it should still have been plenty enough evidence to install him in the Hall of Fame and for grateful nations to carry round banners and statues of his image every year on his birthday. Hal Blaine is the most wonderful talent of keeping metronomic time while still adding in nuances, fills and spills of which others can only dream. Good Vibrations was an autumnal hit that both threw back to the summer just past, but also gave a glimpse of the summer of love, the dawning of psychedelia and the Laurel Canyon misty mornings of the months to come. It heralded that brief moment in time before Charles Manson and before the Kent State shootings really killed that dream. It seemed that anything was possible. And Lyndon Johnson, Lyndon B. Johnson, consumed with his domino theory, and college kids, of course, being sent to kill or be killed in Vietnam. But the alternative culture was showing a new way, not just on Haight-Ashbury either, but in New York, Paris and London. Young people were beginning to believe there was an alternative. And somehow, Brian Wilson captured that perfume and placed it into 3 minutes and 35 seconds of harmony and bliss. And the song moves elegantly from the Carl Wilson, Tanner Kay, Blaine simplicity of the verses to the sort of blessedness and euphoria of the good, 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 good vibration section. I don't know where, but she sends me there. The middle eight of Good Vibrations isn't 8 bars, and it isn't in the middle, but it's a wave of harmony echoing round a huge, Phil Spector-ish cavern of sound. It was as if Brian Wilson had climbed the Santa Monica Hills and returned with a new set of musical commandments. So, yes, all those hours of tape, 17 sessions at 4 different recording studios, each part recorded at different times with as many personnel. It could so easily have been a Heaven's Gate. Instead, Good Vibrations is the most influential pop single ever produced. It's a glimpse into heaven. Recorded February through September 1966, released October the 10th, 1966, number one on the UK Top 40, number one on the Billboard Hot 100, 3 minutes, 35 seconds, The Beach Boys, Good Vibrations.
I love the colorful clothes you wear, and the way the sunlight plays upon her hair. I hear the sound of a gentle moon on the wind that lifts her perfume through the air.
I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations.
Softly smile, I know she must be kind. In her eyes, she goes with me to a blossom room.
I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's by my
good.
two great tracks there to end us with, Magnus Shaw. The Clash, I Fought the Law and the Law Won, and the Beach Boys' Good Vibration.
If anybody fancies hopping on Twitter and telling us what you'd have put in those categories, we'd be very interested to hear. Yeah, that would be good. But right now, I'm afraid we must depart to put some kittens into a bright copper kettle or something. Anyway, I'll thank my esteemed colleague before we do that. That was Terence Dackham.
Be seeing you.
And, of course, big thanks to you, our favourite listener. And seriously, do let us know what you'd have slotted into those categories, because we'd like to hear that. There's always more, of course, over at therockingvicar.com. That's therockingvicar.com. But for now, I just invite you to join us again next time. Why don't you? Until then, we wish you a very big bye-bye.
You've been listening to a Jack and Shaw Media production.
These are